Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. I think we have, for me, an exciting venue for our discussion today. Thank you for the suggestions and questions that you sent in to discuss. Taking a little bit of a different turn, a couple of you have sent in suggestions for discussion, but also asking also me to present a case or a couple of vignettes. We have a presenter of a case, and I'll introduce him in a moment. My discussant, Andrew, in Sydney, Australia, we have gone radio silent, and I have not been able to communicate with Andrew. They've had some storms there, so he is very related to the subject matter of the case. He's a trader. He's a new money story mentor, and was somebody I look forward to hearing discuss, but I don't think he will be joining us, so we'll have to wing it. I'll check in just a bit, but there have been some significant communication glitches. So first, anything you want to add to the venue or add in any way for discussion or consideration for us to wrap into what we develop together for this final seminar? Anything to add at this point? Okay, I have a list of the things that I'll add as the discussion unfolds based on your request. First, let's begin with our case presenter. I really appreciate Mike Giardino, who has volunteered to present a case for us to discuss. Just a brief introduction. Mike is was a CPA with one of the big five firms internationally, was a personal financial planner, and now focuses on being a mentor coach and really focusing, I gather, Mike, on financial professionals. So, Mike, anything else you want to add to that introduction before you...
I think that was, a very compact, accurate description and probably a good intro to where we're going to go with the case.
Great. Thanks for volunteering and do a brief overview. And again, I'd welcome anyone to step in and ask or add at any point, but we'll begin with Mike doing the case and then we'll have an open discussion. So go ahead, Mike.
Thanks, Dave. You know, the profile for the case is I would describe him as a kind of a young Turk, about a 30-year-old guy who was doing some trading, day trading, which is a very turbulent kind of a marketplace to begin with, fraught with all kinds of ups, downs, and bumps. And, you know, he was... winning 2 days and maybe giving, having a third down day. And that was kind of the track that pattern he had developed. And, you know, two out of three will get you into the Hall of Fame if you're playing for the Dodgers. But the problem he was having was that, the money he was taking off of the table in days one and two, he had to put back onto the table and then give the house some on day three. So he really wasn't feeling the love, and he was a little perplexed, and we just got to chatting a little bit. He knew my financial background and my experience with the market, and we started to talk, and I kind of challenged him a little bit, and I said, well, you know, you're looking at a lot of technical things, and those are all really valid points, but, you know, have you maybe looked at how you're your own obstacle in this a little bit, and that might be something to tease out as you develop these new strategies for yourself. So we kind of kicked off from there, and the metaphor I use with him is, people go on diets, You know, they go on diets, but they don't go on diets just to watch the numbers on a scale move down. There's usually an underlying goal, an underlying motivator. You know, it might be health. It could be vanity. It could be, you know, you want to fit back into your muscle shirt again. You know, why are you doing this? And, you know, he had a few ideas of why he was doing it. It was a supplemental type of an income. You know, he had a regular income, and he was kind of doing this as a sideline. You know, when I asked him a little bit more about how much that extra income would be, you know, what would be meaningful to him, he didn't exactly have a good handle on a number or a bogey. So I said, let's zero in on that a little bit. And, you know, the way that I approached it was, you know, what do you want to do with this extra money? What's the purpose of it? You know, how are you going to allocate it? Where does it fit into your more fundamental scheme of things? And, you know, another, you know, nebulous kind of an answer. And we kind of agreed that, you know, he would use it as kind of a vacation fund, you know, something that was sort of outside the budget. It wouldn't affect his lifestyle. He didn't rely on it. But it gave him an opportunity to not only develop a little fund for himself, but there was a reward component to it also over the course of a period of time. So we settled in on that. And from there, he was actually able to drill into a little bit more of a substantial bogey, you know, a number that made sense to him and that was achievable. And once we did that, we now had a platform which had a meaning, which was quantifiable. And then we started to talk about the strategies he was using to make that happen. And it turned out that, you know, he had a number of different strategies that he was kind of managing. And you know, we really just stepped back and said, do you need all of these different distractions, all these different strategies, because it's hard enough to keep track of this stuff? So we skinnied that down. And, you know, he also, as we were doing that, was able to take a little bit of a step back and realize that, you know, maybe he doesn't have to hit home runs. You know, maybe he doesn't have to aim for the big one. Because quite honestly, the success that he had led him to believe that it was replicable in a larger scale. But, you know, he was not just replicating the upside. He was also replicating the risk exponentially. So when things didn't go well, they, you know, didn't go well big.
Can you use some numbers and be specific about that so we can get an idea and in metrics about what he would win in a few days and how he would pay back some third day and what you mean now by big? Can you put some numbers there so we can get a
you know, a good day for him, he'd be able to pull a grand off of the table. So let's say he was able to pull 1,000 off of the table on days 1 and 2, and then he wind up, you know, putting, you know, 2,500 back on day 3. You know, that kind of a metric. So, you know, the up days made him feel good, but the down days, you know, were obviously not so good.
So he had a net loss then, 1,000, 1,000, and give back 25. So he had a net loss then over
right.
A big move. Okay.
That was his problem, you know, and he thought he could work around that by just focusing on what he was doing right on the two up days and do that more often. What he wasn't factoring in were the risks that he was taking in that. And, you know, those risks got magnified for him when things didn't break the way that he wanted them to.
Okay.
So from that, we were able to kind of deconstruct that and develop a coherent strategy that matched, that was achievable, where he could measure the probability of success on those, you know, not every strategy is going to be a winner 100% of the time.
Was that a coaching strategy or a trader strategy? Could you summarize that in a sentence or so?
A trading strategy. I mean, he was doing focused on options, and there are a number of different option strategies that you can do and use on, you know, when you have a sense for where the market is going to go. And he was playing those hunches, and, you know, 66% of the time, you know, those hunches worked out. But the, you know, again, the 34% of the time, they didn't work out bigger. So what we agreed to do at that point was to scale that back a little bit, where he didn't have to have those, you know, really big days. And, you know, he was able to skinny down not just the size of the strategies, the scalability of the strategies, but just the number of strategies. You know, let's take a step back and not have to manage all of these different ups and downs and dials to turn. You know, you're much better off with, you know, the theory was you're much better off with smaller exposure, maybe more often, but more manageable, and being a little more nimble with it, and, you know, being able to do that over and over again, because you need an extended period of time for the probabilities to really work out. It's not going to happen today or tomorrow, but over the course of a long haul, you know, you flip a coin, you're not going to get, you know, heads and tails in equal amounts in 10 flips necessarily, but you will maybe in 100 flips. So, you know, you have to be able to replicate these efforts in large enough numbers before you kind of bankrupt yourself to make it really work the way that it's supposed to work statistically. And he was missing that piece of it. But once he was able to kind of skinny this down into, you know, more manageable chunks, fewer strategies, but sticking with strategies that he could focus on, and really dig into what he was doing, he found a couple of things. One is that he wasn't all over the board. He felt more under control. And that was a big factor. The other thing that he found is that he was able to react a little bit better because he wasn't trying to put out a fire here and a fire there and a fire in the third place. It was really focused. And ultimately what he was able to do is to he developed an ability to look at this less personally. And I think to use an analogy that you brought to the table, Dave, a week or so ago, he looked at it a little more clinically, you know, and less personally. He wasn't, you know, dissecting the cadaver that was somebody's grandmother. He was just focused on, you know, the part of the body that, you know, he might have been slicing up, so to speak, at that point. It was less personal. And from that, he was able to take a step back at the end of the day and understand why things went the way that they did a little bit more coherently. It was less personal. It was less a reflection on his capacity to do this. And then he could really look at why things went well or why things went poorly. And was it the strategy that just didn't fit what happened during the course of the day? And we don't have to discard the whole strategy. It was just one of those days. Did the market do something that was really crazy that, you know, no one really could anticipate or usually see, or was out, you know, an outlier? And you kind of write that off to experience. Were his tactics wrong? was his execution poor? What did he do that was executed poorly that might have impacted that? And how could he not do that again? How could he improve that and stay focused on it? And that's another piece that left him much more under control. So he stopped making what you were referring to as unforced errors. And, you know, the errors that might come up, he could take a look at, understand why they were made, and come up with ways to not make those mistakes again. And once he did that, he started to see things happening more consistently. He wasn't hitting the home runs, and he wasn't having as many strikeouts. He was starting to do it in terms of singles and doubles, and more consistently. It made him feel a little bit better, and more importantly, a little more under control, and a little bit better about the, you know, the entire effort that he was working on. And, you know, over the course of time, you know, the results started to pan out a little bit more to his liking.
That sounds interesting. Thank you for sharing that very much. And congratulations on the success with him. Now, alongside the trading strategies, how did you work directly on regulating his state of mind, staying grounded and centered and not being in a reactive or emotional mode, get triggered? Did you work on that specifically in addition to the trading strategies?
I think the best way to answer that is, I think the approach, without addressing that directly, let's say, that was certainly something that I was focused on. And I think that by kind of paring things back a little bit, making them a little bit more coherent and simplistic, or more direct, that it kind of worked around those issues where he was out of his own way, so to speak. And once we did that, then we could, you know, we would kind of step back and I'd be able to point out, you know, the differences. And we kind of did a post-mortem on it and said, look, you know, think about what your experience now is. And take a look, go back, you know, X number of weeks or months, whatever time frame it might have been. And how did you feel then? You know, compare those two experiences and now look at your mindset. Look at how more focused you are and how less critical you are of yourself and critical you are of your results. You know, he was able at that point to look at the results, good, bad, or indifferent, not be, you know, not be high-fiving himself so much on the great days, but not kicking himself in the butt as badly on the bad days either. It was much more stable and much more sober on both the upside and the downside. And, you know, he didn't need, once he realized, Dave, that he didn't need to hit the ball out to the warning track every time, you know, it actually was okay. He didn't have to prove it. And then things, you know, once he was able to do that, he felt much better both about his approach, his strategy, his results, and himself.
Did you work with him directly at all, Mike, on regulating his state of mind and managing that mindset to sustain it in a focused way rather than moving to a reactive or a triggered state with losses on the downside or wins on the upside?
One thing we did touch on outside of the whole market experience was this, you know, introducing a little Zen, if you will.
Purpose of what specifically? What was your goal?
The goal the goal with that really, you know, when you get into the market and you know the bell goes off, it's like a battle plan. You know, you have a great battle plan, but as they say, once the first bullet is fired, once the first shot is fired, that battle plan, you know, goes out the window, so to speak, and you now have to deal with all of the stimuli that are coming in, and you have to be able to calm all that down. And not be, it's like going into any casino. You know, you walk into the casino, and if you don't have a focus, and this is something we definitely did talk about, in terms of regulation. You know, you walk into a casino, and you've got bells and whistles, and you know, you have, you know, the pit where people are screaming because they're winning, and you have the pit where people are cursing because they're losing, and there are so many distractions. You need to be able to take all those distractions and push them aside. You need to be able I'm sorry, go ahead, Dave.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I thought you were done. I want to be him in just a second to get an idea of how you'd talk to me, but go ahead with that thought. Sorry to interrupt.
The one other analogy, you know, again, using a sports analogy, you know, you're at the free throw line. And, you know, you're down, you have two shots, you're down 1 point, there's a half a second left on the clock. If you're on your home court and you're shooting those shots, the crowd response is going to be one thing. If you're on a visitor's court, they're not going to be quite as friendly. And you're going to need to hit those free throws. You're going to need to push away all of those outside distractions as best as you can and focus on the rim, focus on the basket.
Okay.
And it takes now, a great amount of concentration.
I'm him, and I want to know specifically how you can work with me to calm that down. When the bell goes off for me not to be triggered, how can you help me regulate my state of mind and manage emotion to stay focused on that program in my head, that software program that's going to work consistently without getting triggered?
That's a generic question that can be covered, that can cover a lot of different arenas, can't it?
Just talk to me, though, like I'm him. What would you say to me if he asked you that question? How can you help me right now? What do you say?
It comes down to managing stress and staying
okay,
focused.
How are you
going to be able to bring yourself back to the task at hand? What do you have that is your mark on the horizon that's going to take you back onto course, and how are you realizing when you're off course? You have to do those two things. You have to be able to look at yourself and understand how you are now migrating as a reaction to what's going on, and how you then have to take a deep breath. You know, and it's you know, kind of a stress inoculation response. You have to be able to take your deep breath, put that aside, come back to your game plan. Always come back to your original game plan. Are you on your game plan or are you off of your game plan? You know, that is something that you have access to, and you have to be able to go back to that. Otherwise, the circumstances are just going to completely overwhelm you, and you're going to just be reacting to all the bells, whistles, and noises going on around you. The best way to do that is to refocus on what your original game plan was and get back to it. And that's your mark on the horizon. You have to have that mark on the horizon.
Okay. Okay. All right. Thank you. I think I have an appreciation of that. Let me make a couple of comments and then present a different case dealing with a similar kind of process. So I think we've raised a number of issues that are, I think, really important about managing states of mind, regulating emotion, and staying in a performance zone. You described having a system, a plan, and sticking to it, and described one way of looking at an emotional trigger creating a state change. Now, the state change boots up a totally different software program. If it's anxiety or excitement, it boots up a software program that operates in a particular way, so you're trying to help him to stay grounded and centered and regulated. So let me present a summary of a different case that makes that point from a mentor coaching perspective that just focuses on that to create a system for it. Because I think you incorporate a lot of expertise with trading with mentor coaching. So I want to reference a resource that I have not mentioned before, but there's a 35-minute webinar that it's a free accessible webinar that is Manage States of Mind. It's on the homepage of my website, MentorPath. At the very bottom, click on that bottom link, and there's a 35-minute webinar on managing states of mind, which I think is the essence here of dealing with various aspects of success and the ups and downs of that. So let me present the case that I initially hatched the idea of the neural conditioning chart, and I'll explain that. My client I'm going to call Barbara. She paused during one of our mentor coaching sessions that were focused on her executive leadership to mention almost parenthetically that she would be distracted over the upcoming Thanksgiving holidays and look forward to getting back and resuming her new project at her company. And I heard her momentary discomfort and ask about her expectations of the holidays. She's a very high-functioning executive. And she said, well, I'm really embarrassed to say this, but every time I go home to my family, usually for one major holiday a year, this year it's going to be for Thanksgiving, I have the same issues. And she described a pattern with some reluctance and embarrassment. We have a big family gathering where my parents, brother, sister, and their families all come together for a holiday weekend, usually 3 days. I resolve before I leave that this time is going to be different. I will not get into arguments and fights with my parents and brother and sister. I will not devolve into those arguments. I focus intensely on being balanced, not getting into the squabbles and upset. I can usually last most of the first day, and then something happens and I lose it. I get in a fight with one of my family that escalates. Then I'm in a fight with all of them, and we're at a standoff for the rest of the holiday time. This doesn't happen for me except when I'm there with them. I can maintain my cool at other times, even with telephone visits, but in person, I just lose it. Is there anything you can do to help me with this? And I first reflected on how frustrating this must be for her to want an enjoyable holiday with her family and have things work out otherwise. She agreed and seemed to take a deep breath. So as a sidebar here, state always comes before strategy and story. This was an empathic resonance of her state of mind, so that we together then, from a perhaps calmer way for her, could look at this. And I asked her, At the time you're in the middle of that upset, in arguments with him, what's the age of that conversation? She knew immediately what I was talking about. She instantly said, early adolescence. I'm 12 or 13 or 14 instantly and totally at that time, and I'm stuck there for the rest of the visit. She talked about wanting a close, meaningful relationship with her parents and her siblings. She understandably wanted to share her personal and professional successes and experiences, hear the same from her siblings and about the transitions her parents had made. But in a state triggered by emotion, she only wanted to be right. All of the negative self-statements and all the things that she said were in that time capsule from that instant state change and had not changed since she was 13. In a state triggered by emotion, she was instantly angry, feeling not understood, and saying the same things that she said at 13 and 14. I asked her specifically what she was aware of that triggered her reactions. She described a particular look from her dad, a word from him. I asked her to be very specific, not generalizations or abstractions. A word from her mother, a gesture from her brother, they would instantly create that reactive mode. For example, when her dad rolled his eyes, she was instantly transported back to the time capsule of anger and resentment, of being controlled and criticized by him, feeling not good enough, expecting negative judgment. So I recommended that she schedule a time, an appointment with herself, to do a brainstorming session, at least 20 or 30 minutes, when there would be no interruption and no distractions, and she could reflect on a new plan. I suggested that from a very present and grounded state, that she write a list of each of the emotional triggers that she was aware of with each member of her family. And again, to only reflect on it, observe it, not have them be triggering at that time. So I emphasized the importance of being grounded and centered while she did this, to remain an observer and not re-enter that state of upset with each trigger. I asked her to put these in a column, in a list, and we'll call that column one. Then I suggested at that same time, for each emotional trigger in column one, she put her immediate usual response, whether the thought or feeling or behavior or word she had, in column two. So each trigger had its own reaction. So column two was the reactive behavior or state or thoughts or feeling. This was her age 13 time capsule, column two. I suggested then that she put this aside and schedule another appointment with herself at least 24 hours later so that she could create a third and a fourth column on that same page. The third column would be a mantra for getting centered and present for each emotional trigger. So this column three was the mantra, and it may be the same for every one of the triggers. A mantra now is three parts. A cue that she could use to get focused and grounded and centered. She decided it would be touching her ring. A focus phrase that would align her energy field, hers, she decided would be relaxed and powerful. And then a physiology at the same time, a deep breath for relaxation, to breathe in relaxation and breathe out tension. So in 3 or 4 or 5 seconds, she's breathing in relaxation after she touches her ring, and having a focus phrase that aligns the energy field of her brain to get grounded and centered. So she decided this three-part mantra would be the same for every time she was triggered to get grounded and centered. So she planned this ahead of time so that instead of a usual reactive response and instantly being 13, she could recognize this earlier and earlier each time and move to her column 3, her cue, her focus in physiology. I asked her at this second setting, in addition to column 3, to think about a column 4 and to label that ideal behavior. What ideally would she like to do or respond in response to what otherwise would be a trigger, where she would be off to the races? And that would mean pre-planning what she would do after she got grounded and centered, so she didn't have to make it up on the fly, because this was a new way of responding. So she sent me the initial draft of her 4 columns, and you'll see on the webinar there's a page of the 4 columns, and I can send you a copy if you're interested in that. I emphasized the purpose of the first 2 columns was to cue her radar to recognize not only the emotional triggers, column 1, but also the state change and the content of that state, column 2, as quickly as possible in order to get grounded and centered, to use that mantra. Then she could engage in her ideal pre-planned response for each emotional trigger. In our first session after the Thanksgiving holiday, I was eager to hear how it went. She immediately, and I told her, also, this is not the NBA. You have an unlimited number of timeouts. If you're at dinner and with your family, you feel triggered, you can certainly get up and walk away. You can go to the bathroom and splash water on your face. You can take a walk. You can simply go to the next room. You can call a timeout until you establish or reestablish that groundedness and centeredness so that you do whatever is needed to do to sustain that grounded and centered state. She immediately began the session by saying it was the best holiday she'd ever had with her family. There were times of challenge, understandably. There were even times when she would excuse herself to use the privacy of a walk or just go into the next room to get grounded and centered again in order to reengage the behavior that she really wanted. And she was immensely pleased with her work, as I was for her. She came to realize that previous emotional triggers, even such things that were minor yet were triggering, like her mother would say, "Really now?" And boom, she was off to the races. A particular eye roll, as I mentioned from her dad, could be reframed as the recognition of her humanness, of their humanness, and especially of her adulthood. So the same thing was not triggering when she had a way to get grounded and centered, the mantra, and an ideal response. And the more she did that, the more she moved from that otherwise triggering response to her ideal behavior, that rewires her brain. So that ultimately, all she needed to do was touch her ring, and she instantly could be in that grounded and centered state. She didn't have to use the focus phrase. She didn't have to do even the breathing, because she had rewired her brain for that instant grounding. So after this repetition, her brain was now in a default pattern to create a different response to each cue. So she noted about her Thanksgiving experience. That was incredible, but it was really hard work. My response to her, "I understand how hard and how successfully you worked. The only thing harder, as you already know, is not doing it." So I have some other examples, but here's an example, and those of you who were at the preceding seminar series on performance success, one thing that another way of doing it, so an all-pro cornerback I worked with, because football is an episodic It's not a flow sport where you get in state and stay the same state. After every play, you have to get back in state. If after a really good play, you're just as vulnerable, perhaps even more so, than after a really bad play, or especially after a play where nothing comes to your part of the field and you get bored. So each play, he learned to say, to boot up that very exquisite performance mindset, he simply said, reboot. And that instantly put him in a state of mind that was ultimately beneficial to him. So this is simply a different way than we heard from Mike, or an additional focus on looking at state of mind regulation, which, if you think about some of the things we talked about in the first three seminars, this is especially beneficial after remarkable success and after stimulating things, wealth, fame, power, doing really well, where you don't have a model for how well you do or for sustaining it. This is a model for regulation of state of mind. So the content of wealth, power, fame, all of that stimulation, or the sudden lack of stimulation for somebody who's been an exciting career and suddenly retires, this is a system, a state regulation system that can transcend all of the content that can be anticipated even. And in fact, and I think Mike alluded to this, even just the anticipation can create a state change. When his trader either experienced or anticipated experiencing something either really exciting or really bad, it could create a state change. So here's what we know about emotional triggers. When you hook somebody up with an fMRI who gets excited about gambling, when they approach a slot machine before they ever touch it, they have a spike of dopamine. So they're off to the races just for the trigger of anticipation. So what we know now is that it's the anticipation of something that spikes dopamine. It's not just a reward neurochemical that results in something, because often the result is a success anticlimax. Suddenly, you've had all of these stimuli of dopamine, the excitement of the anticipation, and suddenly the event occurs and you don't have that stimulation anymore. It can read as what happened here. Remember, I used the example, this can be over a sustained period of time. Bruce Jenner, the first morning, after 4 decades of training, so the decathlon said, what am I going to do now? I feel empty. So this is something that can be anticipated, and look, and this also accounts for buyer's remorse. Somebody's understandably confused about something they had been anticipating for a long time. And then suddenly they get it or achieve it. And there's a success anticlimax. It's not what's expected, and they're baffled about what happened. So what we do then in mentor coaching is to look at, as I did with Barbara, a system for managing and regulating states of mind. And as we've talked before, if you want to change, focus on the system, not just the goal, because motivation and goals can get abstract, but the system can be very, very specific. And that can be state specific. Here's an example of how very specific a state can be and how software needs to be developed and entered for a particular kind of performance. If you put a rat, some of you guys have heard me talk about this before, if you put a rat in a maze and teach it to get to the goal, it can go again and again. Now, if before you teach the next rat how to get to the goal, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine to simulate a kind of an excited state, a stimulated state. Teach it to get to the goal, it can go again and again. But if you take away the amphetamine, the rat can't get to the cheese. It can have in a part of its brain the information about how to access the cheese, but it can't access the information. So in that maze, it can literally die of starvation. Now, you reintroduce the amphetamine, it immediately goes to the cheese. State-specific learning and state-dependent memory. This is, as we've talked previously, deliberate practice and a performance flow and a performance state of mind that's re-entered for optimum performance. Think about a practical application of this for your work with clients. You get in a focused state, focusing entirely on your client's story and the co-creation of that story, and you're developing that in that flow state, in that seamless state. And remember back to when you started doing this whole business, when you might stop to wonder what's a good question to ask here, or I wonder about this. That's, in sports analogy, a choke. You have stopped even momentarily that flow, redirected the point of reference to your story, to the point of reference being you rather than the client. So this is where you want to have a way instantly of getting back into your grounded and centered state and focusing on that client. Now, I want to pause have you respond or comment either to Mike or me or both of us for further elaboration and discussion about how this can be helpful to you. Mike, any thoughts you have from what you said and what I said?
You know, there's something that hits me with this that is sort of the flip side of the coin. You know, we've been talking about the dopamine response and excitement and the approach type of mistakes that we make, where we try to be we try to overdo it. What about a panic response? Well, you know, and what comes to mind is the military, the Navy SEALs. They get into all of this training to calm their state of mind so that when they do get into the thick of things, they don't allow fear or anger to take them over. It's not the thrill of victory so much, but how is this, all this stuff relate to threat, panic, to dysregulating us in situations where it's not a fear of missing out, but an actual existential fear?
Okay, the fear of missing out is a kind of theory that can have a cascade, but what you're describing is really fundamental regulation of state of mind and practice, deliberate practice in a performance flow in order to sustain that performance state of mind, so that anything that is a breakdown product of that, like panic, fear, distraction, anything like that is an indication to get back into that state. So this is the deliberate practice and the performance state, whether it's a pro athlete, a Marine, an executive, a parent, whatever that flow state is that can sustain immersion in that regulated state of mind where there's a seamless evolution of a creation of a performance story. Again, whatever the nature of that, you know, business, parenting, major success, this is where the experience of sustaining and regulating a state of mind comes into play, especially with our topic of these seminars. And this is exactly, your question captures exactly why I wanted to address this and to talk about this in live action interchange here, because any of the experiences of success, and especially the things that accompany success, fame, wealth, money, or the downside, the fear or panic or threat, any one of these can get someone off course. So this is exactly what we need to manage. The challenge is it's a greater extension and application for things that have never before been experienced, but it's not the content of the experience, whether it's the threat or the making of $100 million or suddenly having the fame of hundreds of thousands of people in a stadium. It's staying with the regulation of a state of mind and the game plan that will sustain that performance, whatever the nature of it is. Athletic, artistic, executive, parenting, how do you create and sustain a state of mind that can withstand all kinds of distractions and extremes so that you can, with some consistency, maintain and get back quickly to a regulated state of mind? So with your trader, it would be whenever he has an exceptionally bad day, when he loses that $2,500 in about 5 seconds or makes 5,000 in 10 seconds. Those are equal challenges to self-regulate and have a system, at least that will say, what do you do next? And the likely answer to that is absolutely nothing. You stay with your plan. And that sometimes is the hardest. At one of the guys back in the day, who was one of my treatment counselors, said, when you're addicted to something, the hardest thing to do is nothing. And success, addiction, can be, and the stimulation of any of the accompaniments or of the setbacks of failure can be something that can be so easily reacted to unless you have a system, unless you have a plan. So, Mike, does that begin to answer your question about one of the extremes in a negative way about the panic and the situation there?
Yeah, it definitely does. The other thing that it opens up as you're talking about it is, you know, how our imaginations can run wild with us in these things, and we become maybe a little bit more disconnected from the reality of these things. One of the illusions that I had with my particular case, with my guy, I looked at him and I said, you know, you're getting all upset over this stuff. You know, in 10 years, you're going to look at the size of your ups and your downs, and it's going to be butt kiss. This is going to be nothing. I think the other metaphor I use with him is that it's one thing for you to walk into a dark room and turn on the light switch. You don't think anything of it. You know, it doesn't take a lot for you to do that. But if you're 5 years old and you're afraid of the dark, you know, that's a whole nother ball game. You know, you have to, your perspective is a function of your experience.
And as you get more experience,
can you get to where he needs to be to create a system out of what you're saying to him? Can he extract what can I do next?
Yes. He really recalibrated his entire approach with things. He deconstructed everything in large part, reconstructed it in an entirely new way, a very similar way. It's not like he was creating, you know, new tactics or new strategies, but he was applying them differently. You know, he was approaching them differently. And I think the best way to describe it is his relationship with those things became different. And I think that was probably the biggest game changer for him.
Okay. That sounds great, and thank you for that. So let me talk just briefly then. You see in your outline the roadmap system, the seven steps to understand the algorithms that go into creating a story, and by doing that, to look at how to revise it or create a new one. Let's apply that to roadmapping states of mind, which is exactly what we're talking about now. So any emotional trigger can create an instant state change. So awareness of the process is important in recognizing that. So here's the seven-step process for looking at regulating states of mind. Look at your outline for the roadmap to see what the seven steps stand for. First, recognize the emotional trigger that cues a particular feeling or automatic behavior. Then, observe and own your reaction, your awareness. Ownership and accountability are prerequisites of change. These are simply things I'm not suggesting you hand the roadmap system to your client, but these are simply suggestions to process this in a way to think about understanding the algorithms that are 90 to 95% of the unconscious operating system of what you're hearing your client, and a way to concretize and specify it to create a system for understanding, a map for understanding states of mind. So to recognize the trigger, remember Barbara, remember the trader who would get triggered in certain ways, observe and own the awareness of that. Be aware of that state change, meaning instead of just the content, focus on the process, the self-reflection of the experience. Then assess, ROA, assess emotions and feeling, the automatic behavior that results from the emotional trigger. Then decide to engage in a predetermined strategy, to decide what to do. That may simply be to do that mantra, to get grounded and centered. Once you recognize, observe, and assess it, then decide how you're going to get grounded and centered. If you have a simple mantra, if you've already developed it, you just have to touch your ring, you're in business. So map then an ideal response. This is that fourth column. What is your ideal behavior or your ideal response? And then author new experiences. Create that by doing it each time. And the seventh step, program new identity. This is huge now for us as mentor coaches, because the most powerful force of the human psyche is that we always return to our fundamental identity. So if you help your client create a change in behavior or in thinking or whatever they create a change in, unless you also help them in a transformation and an integration of that change into how and who they see themselves, their identity, they're going to revert back to where they were before. So how we do that as coaches to help someone transform how and who they see themselves, their operating model. So this becomes a part of the process of the focus so that they can recognize this and see themselves evolving in doing that and see how they're in a different place, responding differently, seeing themselves differently now than a month ago, than 3 months ago, so that they can internalize this process of self-awareness and self-reflection to do it when you're nowhere on the horizon. The two qualities that were measured in studies by Harvard Business Review, Scientific American Mind, that resulted in the greatest success for executives was self-awareness and self-regulation of states of mind. Now, they only did this study on senior executives. I think it's the case with everyone. Every one of your clients can significantly benefit by doing this, and it can result in greater success and greater self-regulation to have a plan and stick to it. So thoughts or questions? I'd like to hear from you and how you're hearing this, other questions, other things that might be helpful to talk about. One aspect that I wanted to touch on that, and these are some very recent studies, and I think it relates to day traders. It relates to us as coaches who are helping someone make decisions, and especially decisions that they haven't made before. This is the whole focus of this seminar series. There have been some studies on optimal stopping. A part of a lot of decisions is the consideration of optimal stopping, when you stop deciding and do it, in other words. Algorithms of everyday life engage questions about when it's an optimum time to stop an ongoing endeavor, like looking for a new house, a new assistant, or any other choice, when at some point you just gotta stop and decide. Computer scientists have addressed algorithms for such things, which can be complex and evidence-based, to get to a simple stopping point. I want to just do a quick reference here. Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths have addressed this and summarized the knowledge to date in their book, Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions. Because this is our discussion topic for these four seminars, is how do you decide when you haven't decided before, when you don't even have a model to decide. In their book, they indicate that over time, every decision involves an optimum stopping point. You got to stop thinking about it and planning it and do it. In addition to creating a map with strategies and goals, which is our fundamental work with clients as mentor coaching, optimal stopping may need to be factored in at some point. A dozen studies on optimal stopping all reveal that the most common mistake is that people stop too early. And there's always a time factor in decision making. This aspect of time can turn most decision making into an optimal stopping question, choosing the specific time to make the decision. Now, let me give you an example from a decision that everyone at some point may need to stop what they're doing. They may need to retire. They need to make a transition. I, of course, am immune from this because I plan to cross the finish line at full sprint doing this and talking like this until the very crossing of the finish line. But Here's a quote from Lindsey Vonn, one of my favorite people, one of the top three highest super ranking of skiers of all time, men or women. He put it this way. In theory, I expected retirement to be pretty easy. I had a plan. After the World Championships in Ola, I returned to the U.S. where I was going to take 2 weeks off to decompress. Then I would jump into media and events. Simple enough. But when I woke at home that very next morning, nothing was simple. Holy shit, I said out loud, I've got nothing to do. In practice, retirement was anything but easy. It was harder than any of my injuries, harder than anything I've done. As sure as any other professional athletes would agree, the process of easing into retirement can be akin to jumping off a psychological cliff. And she continued, the mental adjustment, this is directly from an interview, from every day being so driven and focused on just one thing to starting all over again was unlike any challenge I had ever experienced. Since I was 9 years old, I always focused on the next thing, the next step, the next goal, the next race, the next title, the next record. During the time when I was injured and unable to train, I could still rely on skiing as my crutch. It would always be there, waiting for me, giving me something to work toward, a familiar place to land. My strength, my confidence, hell, even my identity was so inextricably tied to the mountain. Now I've come face to face with what I avoided all along. I would need to find these things somewhere else. I had no mom. I need to do stuff now, I told my team, who wasted no time in booking me for speaking engagements. And she added, it was really like a part of me died. I had to mourn the chapter I was closing so I could embrace whatever comes next. I was afraid I would never find that same feeling again. So this is her firsthand experience. Even when you're looking to something and have some ideas, you still may not have a model to do that. Now, since you asked, here's an example of using an incorrect model. So what we want to do as mentor coaches is to help the client develop a model that's present, that's accurate, that's not a compilation of past models or simply a transference of something from the past to the present, an old software with slight adjustments, hoping that it'll work now, but really to create a model that fully accounts for current experiences and all the things that need to be factored in. This is a story that illustrates using an incorrect model. One of my favorite scholars, Dr. Daniel Kahneman, tells a story of teaching instructors at the Israeli Air Force about the psychology of performance. He emphasized that a positive focus on skill development for performance works better than punishments for mistakes. So imagine the usual military people of whatever nationality, that's not exactly the way they've been trained or they operate. A seasoned flight instructor immediately challenged Kahneman's research, indicating that his experience on many occasions, he praised flight instructors for good performances, and the next time they performed that maneuver, they usually did worse. So his conclusion, praise doesn't really work. In fact, it works just the opposite. He also noted that after he would scream into a cadet's earphone, after poor performance, the cadet would usually do better. So, on the other hand, if you do negative stuff for bad things, that punishment works better than reward. So, Kahneman, as a good mentor, coach, instructor, acknowledged that the situations where the instructor praised an outstanding performance were likely to be followed by a performance that was less than outstanding. And, exactly as the instructor said, that punishments were more likely to be followed by the cadet's improvement. But Kahneman explained that the reason wasn't necessarily that cause and effect, that punishment was more effective than reward. More likely, it was due to a common leadership fallacy, that if you provide enough excellent information, you will effectively cause someone to change their minds or buy your product. In other words, they will return to the mean. After whatever you do, positive or negative, someone is going to return to the average of what they do. So something exceptionally good, whether you scream or praise, their next performance is most likely not to be as outstanding. Similar for a lousy performance, whether you scream or praise, their next is likely to be way less bad as that was. But it's not a cause and effect. It's simply the best predictor is the average of past responses. It's called regression to the mean. And that principle is important to keep in mind, especially to be sure that you're using a correct model. And the model is not cause and effect in the way the instructor did, but regression to the mean so that it could be approached in a totally different way. Now, thoughts or questions from anything that you've heard or that we've discussed? What else would be helpful to look at? One question that I had that I wanted to sort of circle back to is that we talked about how simply giving information, facts, or data is not going to change someone's mind because a belief, a fact, a data is an anatomical reality in someone's brain, and that simply knowing what to do or knowing the right answer or the right way to do something isn't instantly going to boot that up. Now, here's an example of that in real life. No, it's not in real life. It's in a scientific study. Think about how you learn to ride a bicycle. Now, for this experiment, a bicycle was engineered in a reverse way. And this is Dr. Dustin Santa. He turned the handlebars differently and engineered it so when you turn the bicycle to the left, it would automatically go to the right and vice versa. Now, this seemed like, and this is something that you may think about using as an example to your client. You can't name it and make it so. So it seemed like a simple matter because you recognize that you need to turn left when you want to go right. So you know this. You know exactly what to do. But cognitive understanding to just reverse the usual routine was significantly challenging. Just knowing cognitively was totally insufficient to rewire motor responses because you have to unlearn at the same time you learn. You have to unlearn one schema, one sort of organizing representation in your head in order to replace it with another. And he found that it took several weeks of doing this, of riding this bicycle for 4 to 6 hours a day before it could be rewired. And automatically the people who did this knew to stay out of traffic or any dangerous situation because they didn't have it, even though they knew exactly what to do, it didn't change their brain. So this is important to recognize: a schema, a pattern to organize information and then create an output channel, even for a simple motor skill, becomes operative when you learn a new schema and unlearn an old one. So remember this, that your client will need to have repetition from you. And here's how that's going to sound. After you've said something about the 17th time, your client says, "Why didn't you tell me that before?" So it's going to take repetition, revisiting the process of change, and looking at how to systematically go about that change process. So what else would be helpful? Any takeaways from this discussion today that any of you want to share, or any other questions or discussions?
Dave, it's Mike again. I have one more thought from some of the things that you just walked through a little bit.
Okay.
You know, it just seems that there's a fine line between the virtue of persistence and, you know, knowing when to stop, you know, knowing when to say when. And, you know, looking back at my particular case and my particular trader, you know, he had to get to a point where he stopped making the same mistakes because, you know, practice doesn't make perfect, practice makes permanent. And, you know, sometimes you have to, I guess, realize that persistence is not as much of a virtue as it is at other times. And I guess there's a little bit of a coaching lesson in that to apply to your, you know, to cases, and, you know, how to help
them stop. Because your idea, and this has been shown in performance science, practice doesn't make perfect, practice makes permanent. Only perfect practice makes perfect performance. So every time that, and that's why I ask every client I engage with in mentor coaching and the other coaches who I do mentor coaching with, I did with you as well, not soon enough, to ask if it's okay if I interrupt you for us to look at something at that instant. Because instead of going through the next couple of paragraphs with the same software to stop at that moment and look at things in a different way can be valuable. And that looking at a systematic approach and reviewing and revising that with the client, I think, is important. And that's the importance of focus. Now, think about focus with a client. Can I get a management of the background noise if you'd mute star 6 because there's some techno static from someone? Think about an analogy for focus in working with a client that is analogous to mindfulness meditation. When you relax, focus only on your breath. Relaxation of breathing in and breathing out, only that focus. When your brain immediately, as its job description, will have some kind of thought, or you'll think about something you didn't do, let it go. Let it float away, whatever your way of organizing is. If you're visual, you can let it float away. Refocus on your breath. That's what you can do with your client. To refocus on the client story, on the experience with the client, and help the client to do that as well, to refocus on their story, and that may take an interruption. They've decided for this coaching story session, whether it's a 20-minute session that's a sample session, whether it's a 45 or 50 minute, you've asked them, for example, what would you like us to focus on? They tell you the focus, and you ask, where would you like us to get to? So you created the map. You know where you're going, where you are right now, where you're going, and how to measure progress along the way. Now, that's not the way they're hardwired or softwired, because their wiring is to have a conversational mode, to create free association, to stream of consciousness. They're not wired to have a focus and to pursue that in a systematic way. If they were, we'd all be out of business. So this is what you're teaching them in that session of creating a map for that conversation, and to do that and to pursue systematically in a successive approximation to that goal. And that focus can be powerful because it aligns the energy field of the brain. And when you have the map of that conversation, you can immediately tell and engage your client in reflecting on detours and distractions. So with focus, the brain uses relevance as a North Star. So whatever is relevant then is tied to the goal, and the specificity of the focus is to create a way to address and approximate that. Ultimately, and here's, this goes back to 1804, it's called the Troxler effect. When you stare at a central point and an entire field of blobs, ultimately everything except the central point of focus disappears. You don't notice the blobs. Same with anything, a dot in your peripheral vision. When you continue focusing, ultimately you don't see the dot anymore. So you're helping the client focus on their goal, on their specific focus of what's next, to creating a map to address that, that they're downloading this new model of how you're working with them, so that they have this model to access when you're nowhere on the horizon. So they're developing a system. Everybody has the same goal. We've talked about that before, or pretty much the same goal. Winners and losers have the same goal. And what we heard Mike talk about in his own way is helping his client develop a system, and that system centered around self-regulation and focus on specific goals, not just abstract future goals, but specific goal, a map. So this is exactly what we're looking at. So we just have a few minutes in our extended time. I want to be sure we cover it. Any other questions or thoughts or additions that any of you have? Anything else you'd like to add or ask about this? I really appreciate all of your input and the things you've sent in for us to discuss. Oh, I wanted to get you. I had a suggestion. I almost forgot about it. To give a vignette about how I might use stories or research in mentor coaching, and usually I don't do this. I mean, not that I wouldn't, not sharing with. Usually, it's totally focused on the client development or the client story. But there was a session not too long ago that I used a couple of things, and since it was with a financial professional right up Mike's alley, I wanted to share this. And this is just a vignette, and it'll just take a minute or two. So my mentor coaching client was a successful, high-profile financial professional. He was about to meet with a really important, for him especially, client for the first time. So he wanted to collaborate about a game plan, as we had done in the past. And I said, how long will your presentation and recommendation take? And he said, well, we're going to start about 10 a.m., and it'll usually be about 3 hours because it's a complex investment picture, and a lot of money's involved here. And I asked, when do you plan to have snacks or lunch served? And he said, well, he hadn't really thought about it. He usually doesn't do that. I said, here's something to consider. A study of the decision-based characteristics of 8 parole judges in Israel for a 3-year period was reported in the National Academy of Sciences. Their average parole rate was 35%. At the time when their blood glucose was lowest, just before lunch, and just before the day ended, their parole rate was almost 0%. They were way more critical at that point. After lunch, after they had just eaten, and just after mid-morning and mid-afternoon snacks, their parole rate was 65%. He said, I got there. And I said, one more question. Where will you sit in relation to your client? And he said, well, at my desk, and my client usually sits across. I said, here are a couple of studies from Italy showing when someone sits to a recipient's right ear, when they're talking to the person's right ear, the positive response rate is 72% more successful than when speaking to the person's left ear. I didn't say this, but all of this was information that was elusive to me, and I realized I'd been speaking to my wife's left ear most of the time. Our next session, he reported that he signed the client to manage an initial investment of $28 million. So a couple of studies he used in an informed way, he has already developed substantial skill set and strategy planning. So I just wanted to mention that that's one way. I'm not running in a play. I'm not ghostwriting a story. I'm simply offering something for both of us to consider for him to see if it makes sense to use this. So that's an illustration of the way I might use a story or a study in coaching. Not usually, but sometimes. We just got a minute or so. Anything else, any other major takeaways any of you have you'd like to share with our group? From any of the sessions or today, anything you can put into a sentence or two about a takeaway? It's always helpful, I think, to hear other participants or group members to do a takeaway. Anything you'd like to share? Mike, from our discussion, I'm going to lean on you here, my man. Anything
sure.
that you have a takeaway from our discussion today?
I just seem to think that regulating the state of mind and bringing your state of mind back to the middle. I talked about Zen before. You talked about mindfulness. Those are things that can be applied to almost any situation. You know, you talked about parenting. You've talked about, my particular arena with this guy that was in playing the market. It can be very fast-paced. It can be very slow-paced, relatively slow-paced. But I think life in general is very stressful. And, I don't know that we're really given very many skills in managing that stress level. We're brought up in a kind of a type A society. And sometimes I believe that one of our primary roles as coaches in many cases is to help people get back to that more stable, centered type of a posture so that they can have better results and more command over whatever it is that they're trying to manage, whether it's dealing with a family situation, dealing with a professional situation, or just dealing with, your own personal being.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it in a great takeaway. So just in a, you remind me of something I wanted to say. Just two or three things. As mentor, here's a synopsis of one way to think about what we do as mentor coaches. What we specialize in, change and transformation. What we're expert at, choice architecture. Our framework of operating, collaboration with others. Our sweet spot, helping others regulate a state of mind for optimum responsiveness and peak performance. And what we know, when you want to change, focus on the system, not just the goal. And at a time of unprecedented change and unbefore happened things that we're experiencing, this is a prime time to be thinking about this. So thank you for your participation, all of the suggestions, input, questions. Thanks again, Mike, for presenting and collaborating in this way. I am welcoming anyone, if you have any questions or thoughts remaining, email me. I'll be interested in what you're taking away and what you're up to. So thanks very, very much. It was a privilege collaborating with you. Thanks so much. See you guys now. Thanks again, Mike.